Ms. Pierce, Dr. Hannah, I would like to thank you both for your interest in the inquiry and for your appearance at today's hearing, both in person and virtually. The purpose of this hearing is to assist me in gathering evidence for the Climate Health WA inquiry into the impacts of climate change on health in Western Australia. My name is Taryn Weeramunthri, and I've been appointed by the Chief Health Officer to undertake the inquiry. Beside me is Dr. Sarah Joyce, the inquiry's project manager. So everyone could please be aware that the use of mobile phones and other recording devices is not permitted in this room. So please make sure that your phone is on silent or switched off. This hearing is a formal procedure convened under Section 231 of the Public Health Act 2016. While you are not being asked to give your evidence under oath or affirmation, it is important you understand that there are penalties under the Act for knowingly providing a response or information that is false or misleading. This is a public hearing, and a transcript of your evidence will be made for the public record. If you wish to make a confidential statement during today's proceedings, you should request that that part of your evidence be taken in private. You have previously been provided with the inquiry's terms of reference and information on giving evidence to the inquiry. Before we begin, do you, Hannah, have any, Ms. Pierce, have any questions about today's hearing? Dr. Hannah?
No.
Thank you. I would like to state for the record that I am a long-standing subscribed member of the Public Health Association of Australia, have received state and national awards from the association, and am chair of the Conference Advisory Committee for the Public Health Prevention Conference to be held in Perth in 2020. This latter position is unpaid. Earlier this year, I was an invited speaker at the Public Health Prevention Conference in Melbourne, and PHAA covered my travel and accommodation costs. For the transcript, could I ask each of you to state your name and the capacity in which you are here today, and also ask that throughout the hearing you briefly state your name prior to speaking.
Pat Pierce, I'm the President of the Public Health Association Australia WA branch.
Dr. Hannah, for the record, if you don't mind.
Yes, Dr. Liz Hannah, speaking here on behalf of the World Federation, the Public Health Association, plus I've been called in to assist the PHA and to speak with you regarding their submission.
Thank you. So we'll actually make sure that we record that Ms. Pierce is appearing here as president of the WA branch, and Dr. Hannah's here representing the National Association, also the World Federation of Public Health Association. Is that correct?
Correct.
Great. Ms. Pierce, would you like to make a brief opening statement?
Yes, I will. I'd like to thank you, Professor Weeramunthri, for giving the Public Health Association of Australia the opportunity to appear as witnesses for this inquiry. As the leading national peak body for public health representation and advocacy, the Public Health Association seeks to have better health outcomes through knowledge and evidence-based policy. We are very supportive of the WA government holding this inquiry into climate health. Action to ensure a safe climate is a critical and urgent public health priority, requiring advocacy to ensure a safe environment and a just, equitable and ecologically sustainable society. We would like to note that any costs incurred by holding this inquiry are vastly outweighed by the cost climate change will have and is already having on governments, the community and individuals. We are a member-based organisation and we draw on the expertise of our members when contributing to policy development. So while I'm here today to represent the WA branch of the Public Health Association as the branch president, we also have present Dr. Liz Hannah, a member of the Public Health Association and a leading expert in climate and health. So given her expertise in the area, Liz will be taking the lead on answering the questions you have for us today. So I will now hand over to Liz to give a brief statement.
Shall I start?
Yes,
please.
Okay, Liz Hannah. Liz Hannah. Although I was not part of the writing team for the PHA submission, despite being the previous chair of the Ecology and Environmental Health Group, and remain a committee member, which I have done for about 30 years now. I was also founding president of the Climate and Health Alliance, and I understand you also received a submission from that group. The reason that I did not contribute, although the World Federation did receive an invitation, and as I chair that environmental health group, those activities have been preoccupying me, but also knowing that PHA and the Climate and Health Alliance were both making submissions and recognising that a lot of the input would be covered in both those, but I'm very happy to present today. So by way of a background and to introduce myself, I've served at the forefront of climate change and human health research adaptation for nearly two decades. Tony McMichael recruited me to the ANU to convene the National Climate Change and Adaptation Research Network for Human Health, which was part of the NCAR family, and that was back in 2008. During that time, I worked with all the climate change and human health research groups at every university group across Australia as we strive to attract research grants and conduct primary research into the health risks and adaptation options for climate change as it affected human health in Australia. You may have encountered our State of the Science and Policy series that I edited for the Australian Pacific Journal of Public Health and the discussion papers that we developed. And if you've not had access to those, I'm happy to forward you links to those. My focus spanned urban health, rural health, air pollution, including allergens, water and food security, vector-borne diseases, although I'm certainly no expert on that, heat, fires, and mental health. My major research projects were quite broad, but very much predominating in heat, which drew in my physiological background from my first career, which was in clinical health in intensive care units. So whilst at ANU, I was contracted by the Australian federal and several state governments to lead climate change and health vulnerability assessments, and also internationally, such as the Pacific Islands. I've also supervised numerous PhDs on climate change and human health and examined several others, including some from Western Australia. So lastly, I've conducted primary research examining the trends and health risks across Australia's tropical north, spanning from Broome through to Cairns. So with that aside, I'd like to congratulate you and your team for embarking on this, as well as taking the approach to canvass the wisdom and experience from across Australia as Western Australia moves forward in developing this. And I also note that that has not been without criticism from your opposition and others who would prefer the finances to be spent elsewhere, but I certainly endorse Hannah's comments that investment in health protection in this manner will reap massive benefits in terms of cost savings. And so that was my opening statement. What I do have also that I can add is responses to the specific questions that were forwarded to me. And I can run through those before the questions, if you'd like. How would you like to
see? I'd prefer to, I'll ask the questions and then come to you for the answers, if that's okay?
Yep, certainly.
So before we go to some of the questions which we foreshadowed with you prior to this session, I will just ask a follow-up question to your introduction, Dr. Hannah, which is obviously you've had a long-standing interest in this area. My study of the area has been much more recent related to this inquiry. And so, but when I look at the literature, it seems that the basic science, the basic, you know, health impacts of climate change, how they're described hasn't changed that much in the last 10 years, though some of the causal pathways are possibly better explained now. Is that a fair assessment that the links have been known about for some time?
The initial work was done largely by Professor Tony McMichael prior to us conducting any formal research in this area, and that was based on understanding the health pathways and the relationship between climate and human health, and an understanding of what Australia's climate and climate-related health threats might be. With the Adaptation Research Network that we were funded and hosted at ANU as part of the NCAR FANA, that was part, and the NH and MRC started a deliberate program of funding climate change and human health research projects, some directly through NH and MRC, and NCAR actually funded some additional ones. And so there was $3 million donated by NCAR, in NH and MRC, and $3 million came across from NCAR. to make a pool of $6 million. Sadly, only half of that was actually allocated to projects funded by the NH&MRC, which caused major consternation amongst the research groups. And then Human Health, from 2012, there were no further funds allocated to any research group across Australia to specifically examine the impacts, threats and adaptation options from climate change affecting human health. This also was the source of massive consternation, and not only that, but it also served to diminish our expertise, as we were all forced to stop taking in new students, which meant that there was a pause and a halt in training the next generation of researchers in this space. It also blocked the advancement of knowledge. So in answer to your question, I'd say a lot of that came out in a flurry in the initial few years, and then there's been some stalling. We've had some ongoing studies that have been conducted, most of those through the ARC and several of those, and one or two others, that were not allowed to mention the word climate change. And so there's been a definite hiatus. We know that just with the science and as the data has unfolded, many of the climate predictions have been rolling through, and that we also know that climate change is actually accelerating faster than the initial projection. So we're getting more evidence of the impact that it's having. Sadly, Australia is lagging now behind the world in terms of measuring and monitoring the actual health impacts that it's having upon our society. Whereas once upon a time, certainly the group under Tony McMichael were world leaders, because it was the largest research group in the world specifically looking at climate change and human health. And without the funding, and with Tony's death, alas, that unit pretty much folded. So there's been a hiatus. So to summarise, we got to that point. There's been a smattering of ongoing research since, but in essence, it's very much stalled, which we think is a great shame, when we realise that this is the biggest game in town in terms of human well-being and health.
Okay, thank you. So we'll pick up some of those research issues later on in the inquiry. And it's certainly been raised in some of the written submissions.
Yes. Just on that point, there was an article that Donna Green wrote in Climatic Change that highlighted that, and that was published a few years ago in Climatic Change, and Donna Green was the lead author, and I was given that paper to review, but I was not an author in that paper.
Okay, thank you. And so, there are clearly things that are within the scope of the WA inquiry which relate to national issues, which will, intersect at some point. And so we'll think about how to handle that in the final report. So let me go on to the next question, which is, I might ask first to Ms. Pearce and then to you, Dr. Hanna, which is, what do you think, either from your impressions or from data, is the level of public awareness of the links between climate change and health, and public support for greater action from the health sector? And I might ask you to speak from a West Australian perspective first, Ms. Pearce, and then hand over to Dr. Hanna from a national or international perspective.
Mm-hmm. I won't be able to draw on any data. I can speak as a public health member, public health association member, and the level of support within the association is definitely growing as an issue, and we have members speaking to us quite often about it. It comes up in many conversations in terms of being discussed in relevant submissions and policy documents that we create in preparation of events, including conferences, and we're hosting an event next week on the issue and have had a really good turnout from that. But I will pass over to Dr. Hanna to expand.
Okay, so it's Liz again, and I'll continue. It's difficult to have, because we don't actually have real data on what the general general attitude is. We know that organisations like the Australia Institute recently published their survey on national interest in public interest in climate change. And we know that other groups like the Essential Report and CSIRO also used to do some annual reports. They've waned. They've varied over the years. I think the last most recent one is the Australia Institute, which cites something like 70% of the Australian population do believe, and possibly 60% or more would argue that they recognise that climate change is not only happening, but that it's actually anthropogenic. The thing that waves our arms in the air, I'd have to admit, is the results of the last federal election, which would possibly indicate that maybe that's not necessarily the case. It's not foremost in the mindset of Australians. So what the expectation of the public to human health or health department, the health sector response, I would argue that although it may not be front of mind, the general attitude, of course, in Australia is that people think we have a fine healthcare system. They expect to have a fine healthcare system. They would therefore, even though it's like public health, even though they don't actually see it happening, they just expect it to be happening in the background, and that when there is a health need, that they, and it's always the in brackets they, inverted commas, I mean, would be on top of it and would be there to protect their health. So, as I said, I would imagine that even though we don't have the data, that the general Australian public would be expecting the health sector to be on top of this and to be preparing for it and building their response.
Thank you. Dr. Henry, is there any international data on this issue?
Specific data on the expectation of the general public on the health sector response.
Yeah, and all the level of awareness of the health climate links.
Oh, yes. Australia is, we were doing well some decades ago, and then when there was rampant anti-climate rhetoric from the politicians and indeed the media, that widespread belief went down. So we are lagging behind our other country partners. And of course, that pattern is repeated in most other fossil fuel exporting countries, because it's a deliberate act to befuddle the public's mind, to make them challenge or doubt whether climate change is a real, how soon it's happening, or see whether it's going to harm us at all, or it's got something to do with our activity. Certainly the Europeans and even the Brits are very much on board, but of course they're not fossil fuel exporters. And of course, you know, the Asian countries are very much on board. What we have seen internationally is that once it starts happening in my own backyard, people then start believing in it because they can see it on the ground. So there was a big uptick with Victoria and the millennial drought and the bushfires. Whereas when Sydney and the New South Wales were having lots of rain and they didn't see it, their level of belief was not as high. So it's very much related to that. I've also been part of the most recent publication, which was part of the Lancet series, and that's when we were tasked with writing Australia's Australia's contribution to the Lancet Climate Change and Human Health series, and that we recently published that, January this year, I think maybe, in the Medical Journal of Australia. And one of my tasks in contributing to that was actually comparing Australia's research output on climate change and human health and comparing that to the rest of the world. And indeed, it showed exactly as I mentioned before, we had the world, because it was an emerging issue, there wasn't a lot happening. There was a flurry when it first came to realisation, and then with the investment that Australia had into climate change and human health research, there was a flurry of a flurry of output, research output, and advancement of knowledge.
and then that slowed, and we've subsequently been falling behind the rest of the world. Similarly, the same could be said for mention of climate change and human health in political documents, and also in the media. And so, again, I'd refer you to that article in the Medical Journal of Australia, and Ying Zhang was the lead author in that. But you've probably got access to that anyway. But that's also, it shows the evidence of the fact that Australia has been lagging the rest of the world in terms of research output, focus from our political documents, and the third being media publications and media attention.
Thank you. So we do have access to that paper. So again, just for the record, the Lancet Countdown is an international collaboration documenting what different countries are doing in the climate and health space. There's a specific Australian group of people working on an Australian report that comes out annually, the second of which is due to come out in the next month or so, and we're hoping to have one of the future hearings have as a witness Professor Tony Capon, who is one of the lead authors on the Australian report, and hopefully just after that comes out, so towards the end of November. So we'll look at those issues you've raised and that report in more detail with Professor Capon. So we'll move to the next question. Ms. Pierce or Dr. Hanna, can you describe the concept of co-benefits? What does that mean? And outline what co-benefits might occur as a result of mitigation and adaptation actions.
Dr. Hanna, I'm happy for you to start with that.
Yes. Okay, then, I'm happy to. So in simple terms, the concept of co-benefits is that if you do X with the purpose of trying to unleash positive outcome for health, it will also, that activity, that strategy will also deliver a secondary benefit. So that'll be sort of synergistic positives. The classic example that we often refer to is to heavily promote cycling, primarily to reduce emissions, but the secondary benefits are vast, and of course that includes promoting health, promoting physical and mental health as well as community cohesion, safety, and certainly in the long term reduce health costs, and of course it extends life expectancy. Once you do breach a critical mass of getting people onto bicycles and out of their tin boxes, you find that accidents reduce. So the initial shift across, when there are drivers who are antagonistic to bicycles and you put more bicycles on the roads and the infrastructure's not there, there'll be a short period of increased traffic accidents where cyclists are knocked off cars, either by cars not being aware and very rarely by intent. And so that's been the countries that have heavy utilisation of bicycles, they find that those figures dramatically drop, but they also have over the years developed massive infrastructure. And of course this is, you know, wonderful examples in Europe, but also places like Korea. And it's also a very cheap option for governments to promote health and reduce emissions. So it's sort of the postcard example that we use when describing co-benefits.
Thank you. So so most of the examples of co-benefits that I've seen relate to the adaptation space. So what you've said, yes, you know, increased active transport, decreases emissions, but also improves people's health and... has there been much thought about the benefits of mitigation efforts to reduce carbon emissions in the health sector?
Hanna first and then myself, or?
No, you can go, Liz.
Right. Yes, there has, and you will have noticed in the submission from the Climate and Health Alliance, they would have, and they did put a good deal of effort in terms of the Healthcare Without Harm funded program called Global Green and Healthy Hospitals, which might add is not restricted to hospitals, it includes clinics and such. And they've they've got an enormous amount of material now freely available. And what they're finding, of course, is the actual benefits that happen once hospitals start mitigating severely to reduce their carbon emissions and their footprint, which, of course, can be very large. It's 25% of the UK's government emissions is the health sector. Ours, PHA figure quotes 7%, and I doubt that that is accurate. There has been a recent report that came out September 10 from Healthcare Without Harm, and that's entitled Healthcare's Footprint, I think. And I can forward that to you if you don't have access to that. And again, that's a global summary of healthcare contributing to climate change. And now as far as the, and of course they've been able to measure the reduction in emissions, and we know that the reduction in emissions does actually have a direct positive health health impact. And the thing that's made it very popular with hospital boards is that not only does it do that first thing, which is first do no harm, so the health sector should not be contributing to this problem, but it also, in reducing their waste and transport and water usage and electricity usage and all that, can actually reduce hospital budgets. And it's been shown on numerous occasions that you can track up through their website, that it does this without compromising patient safety or the quality of patient care. Other programs, and particularly the research that we did when I was president of CAHA, was actually having a look and just measuring the direct impact of Hunter Valley Coal on the health budget, and then extrapolated that to Australia, and it's in the billions. So it's difficult in the absence of having, again, the research funding to be able to do that, in that Australia does not have a bevy of accurate and recent data to be able to provide you those definitive answers, other than the fact that the little bit that we do know, it's very, very positive. And of course it's you know, sort of the not biological plausibility, but the plausibility stands firm, given that we do know that most public health expenditure from strategies returns multiple benefits just in health dollars alone, whether that be dallies saved or extended life or whatever. And so the actual benefit, whether it's a 1 in 3 or a 1 in 100 in terms of cost savings for dollars spent, we expect it to be huge.
Okay, thank you. So there are potentially cost savings, so money could be reinvested as a result of savings from mitigation and adaptation action. Thank you. I'll just clarify, from my reading, the 7% figure comes from a paper that was the first paper of its kind trying to estimate the contribution of the health sector to Australia's emissions compared to other sectors, and that came up with 7% of all Australia's emissions are from the health sector. But the 25% figure is the contribution of the health sector to all public sector emissions. So the health sector is a big part of the public sector, and so it's understandable in Western Australia, it's the biggest, you know, state government department, et cetera, and has a large footprint, and so it's conceivable that it could contribute 25% of public sector emissions and 7% of all emissions. So just clarifying that point.
Yes, that's a point that's well made, but I would still argue that I actually would suspect, and again, single study in some time ago, I would expect that if we were able to repeat that, we would find it higher, certainly nowhere near the 25%, because as you correctly point out, that's of public expenditure, not total, public emissions.
Okay, thank you. So we've got about 15 minutes left. I've got three questions, so maybe we'll just spend a few minutes on each of them. In the health system, we have obviously clinicians and public health professionals and a range of other people. But just sticking to the roles of clinicians and public health professionals, what are their respective roles? How could they work together, either in mitigation or adaptation?
Dr. Liz, I'll ask you to start with that.
Righto. The there's a range of roles. The first one, as we said, the health sector should be leading by example and showing the rest of the world and the rest of society, yes, it is possible to reduce your emissions. It also, because the health sector is non-political, and we don't have a vested interest other than keeping people healthy and safe, the role of the health sector as advocates is huge, and that's part of the reason, the underpinning as to why we set up the Climate and Health Alliance, and it's obviously one of the reasons why the Public Health Association and others are really stepping up to the plate to put the health sector voice forward in terms of we really do need to reduce this because we are a trusted, valued and a sort of non-biased voice in terms of having nothing to gain by taking anything because it should not be perceived as a political thing. And so advocacy from our professional setting as well as individually at home is another role for the health sector. Another one, of course, is that our responsibility to provide health services. And so it's an important thing for the health sector and health departments to invest in building the resilience of the health sector so that all aspects are able to continue providing services as they are needed. And so stepping backward from that, obviously there's a role for all states, all jurisdictions to conduct quite extensive health impact assessments, specifically for the nature of their population and the various demographic components, but also their climate and the likely health or the likely climatic impacts that will be heading their way. Western Australia was pretty much leading Australia with the initial report by Jeff Spickett and Helen Brown and Diane Caturin. And many states actually followed theirs, but that was some years ago now, and I haven't seen an update, but I could well have missed it. But it's an important thing and I think led by the state government and the health department to conduct that or take the lead on it, incorporating all the CSIRO projections, incorporating much like the study that Neville Nichols and Margaret Loughnan did, the pair from Monash, and what they were doing, this was a heat study, and that was they overlaid the temperature across the major metropolitan regions, and then they located the SES vulnerability LGAs and hotspots to identify a map of hypervulnerability to things like heat. And that study ought to be done pretty much across the state, I would argue. No doubt the state has access to low-lying areas and sea level rise because the literature is increasingly showing that we need to start planning for retreat from the coastal regions for those that are vulnerable. And there's all of those as far as the health impact assessment. The state also should have responsibility for ensuring that the health services can continue to function through slow creeping climate change as well as with the disasters that you know that are going to happen. So the West is going to have, you've got Cyclone Ali up near Broome, and you know that some of your tropical cyclones come down and tuck underneath Cape Lewin. And so building codes need to be able to withstand the increase in velocity of winds if we're going to see more Category 4 and 5. The low-lying areas that are subject to either coastal or riverine flooding, because clearly, as you will recall, Kent Hospital having to evacuate, when was it Yasi or Debbie, whichever cyclone was barrelling straight towards Kent, it's inappropriate clearly to have a hospital that should be ramping up to provide services when it itself is vulnerable to catastrophe when we know these things are going to increase. I mean, that's a more dramatic thing, but it's certainly making sure that in fire-prone areas that the areas that are going to be drawn upon and in demand when fires and heat waves and storms come barreling through. So the health sector needs to run through all of those. And as far as the practitioners are concerned, I think it's very, very important for it to get into the curricula of all the mob coming through. I was trying to do that and had some success in Victoria when I was teaching undergrads down there. But of course it was great resistance. But they also need to have modules to upskill the existing workforce. And again, relevant to what their patient service, client service is. Interesting things that come to mind, of course, are providing advice, such as heat is a massive issue for Western Australia and will be increasingly so. Do you or do you not exercise? At what point do you stop exercising? Making sure that everyone, so we do the health promotion, and so that practitioner to client can provide that health education, but also to be leading health promotion campaigns. And I'd argue that even school kids need to be able to recognise signs and symptoms of heat stress, and to be able to differentiate when is an emergency call an ambulance or when is just have a drink, rest and sit down. There's also the things of certain medications that we know, particularly a lot of the cardiac ones, that will reduce your physiological response to cope with the heat, and of course they can be detrimental during heat waves.
Okay. So those we might just pause you there because we will be able to explore heat with some other witnesses. So I might just ask a couple of questions which I think you and Ms. Pearce are particularly well placed to answer. So the first one is, what can WA learn from other jurisdictions in Australia and New Zealand? Which other states or territories are doing this well, and what could we learn?
Liz, you go.
Okay. I'd argue that none of them are doing it particularly well, because we've had this long process of resistance to climate change, and I'd argue that you could possibly get some better ideas internationally. There's certainly a lot of interest in moving forward in this. Some of the health departments that you'd be familiar actually have things on their website, but of course not everyone in the community, and particularly the most vulnerable groups, are unlikely to go and check out a health department website. So one of the things that is important also is to put the scan further afield, and you'll find important things like massive advertising campaigns that are funded, whether it be nationally or by the state, in terms of really getting the message out so that people are well protected and they can assess their own level of risk and then know what's the smart move in terms of protecting themselves and their family and helping out each other. Interesting things, I mean, there's some good stuff that's happening in terms of messaging that goes out, but, you know, there's been some appalling things, such as the Victorian government spent quite a bit of time just replicating the Bureau's message. Well, people in the health sector can tell, because the Bureau is very, very good in telling us that a heat wave is coming, and it's sort of wasted effort for the DHS in Victoria to then start putting out alerts to their health, you know, their health agencies. And that's, you know, that's less than ideal when more specific advice would be better.
Thank you. So last question. You mentioned in your submission from PHAA some suggested changes to public health legislation. So my question is, what role can modern public health legislation play in addressing climate change impacts on health?
Well, I can start. So our submission referred to a report by a new medical student and Dr. Peter Tate, who's the co-convener of PHA's Ecology Environmental Special Interest Group. They looked at public health acts around Australia and what opportunities there are for chief health officers to use those acts to help mitigate impacts of climate on health. So it looked at the 2016 Public Health Act, which is quite a recent report, and I believe the report and the associated letter in the Australian and New Zealand Public Health Journal are both open access, but if not, we can provide them. It did note that WA already does have some available powers for the public health officer, so ensuring environmental health, appointing environmental health officers, monitoring air and water quality are among some. And there are opportunities for action, including monitoring and publicising local links between temperature and air quality and the health impacts that they have, quantifying the cost of the healthcare system, strengthening the link between public health and other relevant departments, including energy, and monitoring and reporting on the industries that have an impact on climate. I believe Dr. Peter Tate would be happy to speak with you if you'd like further information on that report, but Liz will probably be able to expand on that.
Thanks, Hannah. So my response was going to be pretty much to defer to Peter Tate, who's unavailable at the moment, but I'm sure would be very happy. Because I'm still on the committee for the Environmental Health SIG for PHA, Peter's been pushing this forward even beyond the publication of that paper, and we've pulled in some of the other current and recent past members of the SIG who have been directors of environmental health for the various states around Australia. You know, so Roscoe Taylor, Peter Sainsbury, Linda Selvey, and of course you're probably familiar with Jim Dodds over yonder. I don't think we've been speaking to Xavier Schoburn from NT, but specifically because of their expertise in understanding not only the Act, but what changes might, what threats might come or how it might be best used to roll forward with this. And so Peter's been, and I've been party, but I've been deferring to these heavy public servants with their leading positions. And so perhaps I'd suggest encouraging that group through Peter for you to have a specific conversation with them in terms of how this might move forward, because again, everyone's interested. Some of them are not necessarily in their roles anymore. Some of them might have retired, but still, it's an important area. And I think the best answer is to come from those bureaucrats.
Thank you. And we'll close it there. I'd like to make a final statement, which is firstly to thank you, Ms. Pearce, and yourself, Dr. Hannah, for your attendance and your input to this hearing today. A transcript of this hearing will be sent to both of you so that you can correct minor factual errors if orders placed on the public record. If you could please return the transcript within 10 working days of the date of the covering letter or email, otherwise it will be deemed to be correct. While you cannot amend your evidence, if you would like to explain particular points in more detail or present further information, you can provide this as an addition to your submission to the inquiry when you return the transcript. Once again, thank you both very much for your evidence.
Okay. Thank you. And those articles that both Hannah and I mentioned, do you have access to those, or is there anything you'd like us to forward to?
We probably have access to most of them. We'll check the transcript and we'll get back to you if we need some help. Thank you very much for your offer.
Okay then, thank you.
Thank you. Take care. Thanks a lot.